It's always dangerous to speak at 1 o'clock. And I don't have the picture show this afternoon. So this is much more of a straight lecture. And it focuses on Princeton, which is a love of mine as a result of my PhD work. And I'm building on what I did in that original work. It's not as if you have to know the piety of the Princeton theologians in order to appreciate this, but it's meant to build on some of the work that I did in that book. But I also think that it is will also build on what we've done so far. And I'm paying special attention to Princeton because I believe that Princeton, at its best, tried to manifest the idea of piety in all of its various ramifications at a crucial time in our history. So we'll look at how Princeton, what its goal was in the overall theological scene, and see how their view of piety fit into that. Dallas Willard delivered a lecture, Christ-Centered Piety, as a part of a colloquium inaugurating the professorship of Evangelical Studies at Harvard in 1998. I don't know whether you knew that there is a special emphasis at Harvard, and he delivered this lecture inaugurating that in 1998. He defined piety as the inward and outward states and acts that constitute a life of devotion. That's a very broad definition. By some of the things that I've said already last night and today, we might assume that piety focuses primarily on the interior elements. But I think that Willard is correct. It concerns certain inner aspects, but also a certain outward acts as well, which we try to focus on. This broad definition does full justice to the notion of what piety is. At their best, Princetonians sought to maintain a close relationship between what could easily become fragmented. They tried to hold it in a clear balance in their own views. They envisioned a healthy correlation between the objective and subjective aspects of Christian religious experience. Their desire was to have the inward activity of the heart be reflected also in the way that life is carried out and in the activity that believers have in the world. This is also illustrated in Gordon Tate's book, The Piety of John Witherspoon, which was published in 2001. Tate defines piety as true or authentic religion, a genuine love of God and of neighbor, or a faith and conduct joined with unqualified integrity. Witherspoon's service antedated the formation of Princeton Theological Seminary, but Princeton was the recipient of several things from Witherspoon. He accepted the presidency of the college in 1768, and he was famous for exemplifying the remark that Cousin America has eloped with a Presbyterian parson. He was, of course, the sole minister to sign the Declaration of Independence. Witherspoon's piety consisted of several elements. He brought a love for the Westminster standards, a zeal for inspiring piety in the pew and the pulpit, and a conviction that genuine piety results in the practical application to everyday life. So Witherspoon's holistic view of piety as involving not only what one believes, how one acts, and how one effective life is influenced by the gospel. Now, those who have written about Princeton have also focused on its distinctive piety. And Mark Knoll and David Calhoun say that the emphasis on piety at Princeton was no accident. In 1812, Presbyterians desperately faced a situation of a lack of pastors. And the state of the ministry at Princeton, at the Presbyterian Church in the post-revolutionary area, was significantly lacking in the production of ministers. The major leadership at the seminary was now producing folks going out into public life as opposed to going into the ministry. So Samuel Miller noted that there were 400 vacancies in the pulpit throughout the country, and he delivered an impassioned plea in front of the General Assembly, give us pastors, give us pastors, give us pastors, because there were so many vacancies that were open in the church. So the Presbyterians were not alone in this dilemma, but the preparation of pastors was a crucial concern at the opening part of the 19th century. And it was perceived that the American religious life was declining in the opening part of the 19th century. There was an alarming growth of population, expansion into the Western territories, and society was becoming secularized, and that the grounds of the Christian faith were losing to the growing forces of irreligion. New religions, new leaders such as Thomas Jefferson in government appeared neutral in their religious convictions, and people saw this as boding ill for the country. So this called for drastic measures, and the formation of a theological seminary was deemed to be of the highest importance. Now, when they drew up the plan of the seminary, they were very clear as to what they wanted to produce in Presbyterian pastors. They wanted, first of all, to have an intellectually demanding curriculum. The plan was very carefully explicit about what they wanted their pastors to know. First of all, a pastor was to be well-skilled in the original languages, so that when he studied the Scriptures and exposited the Scriptures, he was dealing with the Greek text and the Hebrew text. He was, secondly, to be able to explain and illustrate Scripture. He wasn't just a Greek and Hebrew scholar and could know the text, but he could use those tools to make the Scriptures come alive for people in expository preaching. Thirdly, he was to be able to demonstrate a full acquaintance with natural, didactic, polemic, and casuistic theology. He had to be well trained to know the various distinctions given by those terms. And, of course, have a particular acquaintance with the history of the church. I like that. But the important thing was that conjoined with this intellectual training, that every minister was to be a minister of piety. In fact, the term that was frequently used was that the seminary was to be a nursery of vital piety. The plan says, quote, it ought to be considered as an object of primary importance by every student in the seminary to be careful and vigilant, not to lose that inward sense of the power of godliness which he may have attained, but on the contrary, to grow continually in a spirit of enlightened devotion and fervent piety, deeply impressed with the recollection that without this, all of his other acquisitions will be comparatively of little worth, either to himself or to the church of which he is to be a minister. Now, what a great balance we find there, a balance between the head and the heart, in which, well-trained, using the languages, well-versed in theology, and balanced with the vital piety. So the distinctive aspects of Princeton from the beginning sought to have the balance that we've been looking at as being moved back and forth by the pendulum between various movements that preceded it. Princeton was to try to bring together all of those and hold them together in balance and equilibrium. Now, the question is, of course, is what patterns of religious experience did they try to inculcate in the pastors, the future pastors, which would then pass along to their congregations? What models did they provide for people to come to faith? Is there any order between instruction and conversion? What expectations were people to have for their children? How were they to raise their children in such a way as to instill this as well? Now, Princeton viewed itself, for as long as it could, as a via media, a middle way between two extremes. And they were able to accomplish this for as long as there were still people on either flank. Now, eventually, Princeton kind of became the right or the conservative view, and eventually there were no people kind of to one side. But for a long time, Princeton was able to present itself as a via media, a middle way between the extremes of rational, speculative religion, the deism that we talked about this morning, and on the other side, various manifestations of subjective religion, such as mysticism and extreme revivalism. The plan of the seminary substantiates this desire to walk the middle course. Now, first of all, they saw themselves as an antidote to moralistic deism. Archibald Alexander and Charles Hodge both articulated the normal pattern of Christian religious experience, that genuine devotion or piety was to flow out of the understanding of Christian doctrine and Christian truth, resulting in a life of devotion. So they were against the speculative rationalist opponents who, as we saw this morning, looked upon those acts of piety and devotion as excess baggage, as things that could be eliminated. Princeton claimed to inculcate nothing less than traditional Reformed theology. They demanded piety as a necessary constituent element, and they realized that Calvin was saying the truth. It's easy to write the theology. It's sometimes difficult to instill the piety. So the deistic moralists, like Immanuel Kant, who were repudiating acts of devotion such as prayer, meditation, hymn singing as the essence of Christian worship, they saw themselves as countering that notion. Their whole religious a priori was rationalistic in nature and opposed to the notion of the general idea of religious worship. Reformed piety, however, was also the antidote to religious subjectivism. At the other end of the spectrum, from speculative religion, was American revivalism. Now, I realize we did not get to that. That's where I stopped on my outline this morning. So let me say something about Finney and what he represents. Finney represents, in the opening decades of the 19th century, the idea that revival is not something that God sends, it is something that man accomplishes. And in his very famous lectures on revival of religions, Finney blatantly says that as long as we use the divinely constituted means, which were the new measures, then revival would come if we simply put to work the means that are there to accomplish it. So Finney said, just as a farmer uses certain means to produce a crop, if you use the new measures, consisting of the anxious bench, including protracted meetings, including campaigns, then revivals will result. And it is simply the appropriate use of the constituted means. And revival is not something that Edwards says, the surprising work of God. Revivals are the work of man. Man can produce revivals if he uses the properly constituted means to bring them about. So Hodge and Alexander saw themselves while having themselves been influenced by revivalism. Alexander professed a conversion experience during a revival in Lexington, Virginia in 1789, and Hodge responded to a revival at Princeton in 1815. But both remarked that the primary aspects of their faith were not associated with revivalistic experiences, but were rooted to the way in which they were raised in the church, the way in which they had been disciplined in life prior to that. They said that their religious experience, apart from the revival, were more accurate in explaining their piety. Hodge said, for example, that his godly mother drilled him in the catechism. And in that drilling and in that memorizing and in that learning, that inculcated within him the piety and devotion that was so crucial to him. So unless piety was grounded in revealed truth, he was subjected to severe distortion, to the emotions, to the manipulation of revivalists, and so forth. Now, there were two streams that formed Presbyterianism that would help us to understand what Princeton was about here. There were two strains in American Presbyterianism, the English Puritan strain and the Scots-Irish strain. The two converged in the middle colonies to form the American Presbyterian Church, and each brought with them a slightly different understanding of the nature of the Christian life. Both claimed to believe in the Westminster standards. They thought that the Westminster Confession was vital to genuine piety, but the English Puritan strand stressed an additional element of experiential religion as necessary to genuine religious experience. So let's look at the difference between the Scots-Irish approach and the English Puritan. The Scots-Irish view of piety, sometimes called the old school, anti-revivalist position, did not stress individual experience of salvation as much as it did acceptance of the truths of the confession. They rejected the gathered approach conception of Baptists and Mennonites, which said that membership in the church would be based on your being able to espouse a definite conversion experience so that it was very sure that it was a true gathering of saints. As was mentioned this morning, Dr. Barrs mentioned this morning that some of you can date your conversion experience very explicitly. Others of you may never remember a time in which you did not have total trust in Jesus for your salvation. Well, the Scots-Irish rejected the view that the conversion experience is absolutely essential to your being a member of the church. Robert Osmer, in his work Confirmation, Presbyterian Practices and Ecumenical Perspective, said that the Scots-Irish view had the nurture-development model of the Christian life, that nurture produces development. He contends that nurture belongs in the foreground, since in this view, the profound mystery of God's election cannot be understood simply by examining one's experience. Neither dramatic conversion nor verbal testimony guarantee one's salvation. So spiritual introspection may actually work against genuine piety if one thinks that there has to be a datable conversion experience. The Christian life depends heavily on the nurture provided by the ecclesial community, because development largely is a matter of understanding and appropriating the practices it offers with increasing depth. Participation in the ordinary means of grace allows the elect to recognize the inner witness of the Spirit and gradually grow into the covenant responsibilities of the normal Christian life. So with this nurture and development model of the Scots-Irish, the nurture of the individual is primary. And whether one has a datable conversion experience is not crucial to that nurture and development. Now, Charles Hodge illustrates this to a certain extent. He models this version of religious experience because in his autobiographical sketch, which appears in the biography written by his son, this is the way that Hodge explained his own religious experience. "There has never been anything remarkable in my religious experience, unless it be that it began very early. I think that in my childhood, I never came nearer to conforming to the apostles' injunction, pray without ceasing, than in any other period of my life. As far back as I can remember, I had the habit of thanking God for everything that I received and asking Him for everything I wanted. If I lost a book or any of my playthings, I prayed that I might find it. I prayed walking along the streets, in school, out of school, whether playing or studying. I did not do this in obedience to any prescribed rule. It seemed a natural view of the Christian experience, and it reflected the effects of teaching in his life." And so therefore, when Hajj talked of his religious experience, it was dated from the very earliest days that he could remember. Now initially, those supporting revivalism, like Gilbert Tennant, who we talked about this morning, understood conversion in the context of catechizing covenant children in the Westminster doctrines. But the focus changed as the Second Great Awakening emerged. The Second Great Awakening under Finney, when the revivalist experience were seen as being something that one could work up themselves. According to this view, the goal of catechizing changes significantly. Old school nurture, which began with baptism and continued in catechetical training, culminated in an adult profession of faith. But the new model transformed the purpose of catechizing from a nurturing process to an instantaneous conversion experience. Osmer says this, "The importance of theological or scriptural knowledge gained through a lengthy period of education and discipline in the church was now giving way to an instantaneous view of Christian conversion. Thus, conversion came to be understood no longer as occurring within the context of nurture and discipline and maturing, but as a freestanding, independent of the nurture of the church." Now, you can see that that would change the whole understanding of the religious experience. The implications of this were not lost on Charles Hodge. Hodge lamented in the Biblical Repertory and Princeton Review that Charles Finney's revivalism not only intruded Pelagian doctrine into the Presbyterian Church, which it did, but that it also had an effect upon the religious life of the church. It profoundly affected the piety. The number of infant baptisms, for example, plummeted severely within the new school churches. And so therefore, with the notion of infant baptism followed by nurture, if the emphasis is going to fall on conversion, then why baptize the child early? Let the baptism follow after the conversion experience, because the conversion experience is the primary means by which one's Christian identity is understood. So he pointed out that the old school churches reported three times as many baptisms than as the new school church did for every 1,000 church members. So decline in baptism further reduced the number of children, obviously, being catechized. So Osmer summarizes that the new school views changed the traditional Reformed understanding of piety, whereas Tennant attempted to synthesize the spiritual writings of the English Puritans with the Westminster Standards, the emerging Second Great Awakening produced something new. As the creative impulse of these persons, like Tennant, was swallowed up by revivalism, their legitimate insights into the place of crisis, inner struggle, and personal piety were turned into a formulaic understanding of conversion that frequently was anti-intellectual and manipulative. Now, what you can see here is that what we find is a radical shift taking place here. Instead of the beauties of Christian nurture, of raising covenant children, and seeing that if one does have a conversion experience, it's in the context of having been catechized, nurtured, disciplined, being considered a member of the church. That's totally different from the view that was being popularized here by the Second Great Awakening, that when you take that seriously, it's a disadvantage to be brought up within a Christian home. Better to live, now no one would explicitly say this, better to live a life of sin so that you can have a dateable Christian experience than to have grown up with some of the ambiguities of being raised in a home and being disciplined and so forth. Wouldn't it be better simply to have religious experience dateable with a conversion experience? And therefore, the implications of revivalism were that therefore catechism and nurturing are relatively unimportant. It's so much better to be able to date your conversion from a time of revival. Now, one of the interesting outcomes of all this is Hodge's review of Horace Bushnell's book, Christian Nurture, which came out in 1847. There was not very much that Charles Hodge and Horace Bushnell saw in common in their theological views. But when Bushnell wrote this book, Christian Nurture, Hodge gave it a very favorable review in the Biblical Repertory. His main objection to Bushnell's view of nurture was that nurture had a kind of naturalistic cast to it. He says, "The whole tenor of his book is in favor of the idea that all true religion is gradual, habitual, acquired as habits are acquired. Everything must be done like a natural process, nothing out of the regular sequence of cause and effect." And that is generally the tenor of the way that Bushnell understood Christian nurture. Despite this glaring weakness, which does not allow for the supernatural work of the Holy Spirit, Hodge found much in the book that was commendable. He said he paid the book the highest accolade in saying that the phrase Christian nurture has the power to give his discourses very much of an old school cast and to render them in a high degree attractive and hopeful in our estimation. What made Bushnell's views attractive was his insistence that revivals received attention at the expense of depreciating the education in the home. Bushnell stressed community life rather than focusing merely on the individual's relation with God. Hodge further commented that the relation between the piety of the parents and that of their children is a divinely constituted relation, which should lead them to expect their children to become children of God. His confidence in such a relation rested in his belief in the covenant providence and the providence of God. Hodge, for example, analyzed the Abrahamic covenant, and he argued that faith in God's promise should produce the expectation that God would bless child rearing to result in repentance and faith. From its earliest infancy, the child is the object of tender solicitude, the object of many believing prayers. The spirit which reigns around it is the spirit not of the world, but of true religion. The child is sedulously guarded as far as possible from all corrupting influence and subject to those which tend to lead him to God. The child thus trained grows up in the fear of God, and his earliest experiences are more or less religious. Well, that sounds exactly like the quote that I gave before of Hodge, of his early childhood experiences being filled with faith, that his life was one of prayer, and his expectation was that God heard his prayer and dealt with him. So Hodge illustrated this notion, nurture, development version of the Christian life, and he saw his own religious experience, and he even interpreted Bushnell's view. Now, Hodge was aware of the fact that there were potential drawbacks to the nurture development thesis. That if one looked at the nurture and the use of catechism with the wrong view in mind, that there could be serious harm that could come from this. He wrote in the review of Sprague's lectures to young people in 1831, Hodge cautioned against a too formalized approach in the use of the catechism. He says the mode of exhibition must be adapted to the comprehension of the child. Nothing is gained where nothing is understood. The mere storing the memory with abstract propositions, although embodying the most truth, can have no effect on the child, on the present character of the child. And he even used the phrase that some catechizing done in this way could just produce parrots. That is, the child just cites out of memory without truly understanding what he is reciting. But A.A. Hodge confirmed that the true nature of catechizing the child was to inculcate that spirituality, that development. The role of the parents, they must teach them, their children, their relationship to the church as baptized children ought to be sedulously impressed on their minds so that the piety is engaged. A.A. Hodge confirms this when he says that to our mother, to my brother and myself under God, we owe absolutely everything. To us she devoted her life. For us she prayed, labored, and suffered. So what could become a mere formalized, ritualized experience of memorizing and parroting back was to be carefully guarded with the notion of a warm and affectionate heart and vital piety. So what we find then in the history of Presbyterianism in the 19th century was a crucial juncture here of how was the catechism to be used and how was conversion experience to be understood. In the nurture development model, conversion took place within the context of nurture. But within the crisis view of conversion, a totally different model was presented, and eventually the notion of baptizing children, catechizing them, and having them learn the matters of the Christian faith tended to fall by the wayside. And of course, interesting what has happened within American religious experience is that the primary means by which education is carried on in the church has become the Sunday school rather than the catechizing experience. The Sunday school movement was started by Robert Raikes in 1790 in England. And Raikes started the Sunday school movement because there were children who were not being educated and not being trained, and the only day of the week that they had off from their work in the mines and in the factories was Sunday. So he started the Sunday school movement in order to educate these children. Well, what the mainline denominations did was to adopt the Sunday school movement as almost the exclusive means by which education was carried out, and eventually, in the mainline denominations, Presbyterianism included, that was that the catechism tended to be replaced by the Sunday school, and we know that within the mainline denominations, the Sunday school education tends to be biblically oriented up through the sixth grade, and then all of a sudden, when they graduate into junior high, issues takes over, and for many people, their knowledge of the Bible doesn't exceed what they learned in the first six grades, but after that, all the Sunday school tends to be focused on topics and other relevant issues. So Princeton maintained the necessity of the use of catechism, and it saw the catechism as a means by which a vital piety would be instilled. And they had a place for conversion experience so that the nurture development trajectory could obviously include the element of conversion, a radical conversion experience, but the radical conversion experience was seen within the context of the religious life as a whole. So Princeton maintained a wonderful balance here of head and heart. It knew where to place the conversion experience, but it saw as the primary element of Christian education and the inculcation of piety as lying within the use of the catechism and therefore instructing the children in the faith. And I think that that therefore this model of Princeton as standing between the rationalism of deism on the one hand, which wanted to throw off the piety, and the new piety of revivalism that wanted to say that the central element of the Christian faith was a datable conversion experience, Princeton saw itself as being able to see itself as a via media between these two extremes and maintained a balance that is commendable and therefore worthy of being modeled in the 21st century as well.